Hi, I'm Ted Burns. I'm a neuromuscular specialist at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. And today I'm speaking with two patients with myasthenia gravis, Esther Land and Lisa Gigliotti. Esther and Lisa are both very involved in the MGFA, and it's great to have them on the line today. Esther, Lisa, and I have also carried out one other interview, and that was posted as a podcast in September 2011. And if you haven't listened to that yet, please consider doing so. Now, the theme of today's podcast interview is the patient perspective. And today, I'm particularly interested in Lisa's and Esther's thoughts about medications used in myasthenia gravis. Now, before I talk to Lisa and Esther, let me also mention that the MGFA put out a podcast in February 2011 about the basics of treatment, and that was a physician's perspective on the basics of treatment. And in that interview, I interviewed Drs. Matt Mergioli and Henry Kaminsky, so please also consider listening to that interview. In that interview, we talked about how important it was to understand the severity of the patient's MG and to tailor treatments and to talk and understand risks and potential benefits of treatment. Okay, with that, let's jump right into today's interview. I'm going to ask Esther and Lisa to summarize their experience with treatments for myasthenia, and why don't we start first with Esther? How about you, Esther? What has been your experience with treatments for myasthenia gravis?
Thank you, Dr. Burns. Okay, I was diagnosed with MG in 1950. Long time ago. My initial treatment was Mestinon, which is the generic name pyridostigmine bromide. It's an anticholinesterase medication that, to put it simply, speeds up the action at the neuromuscular junction. Mestinon continues to be the drug that is first used when a patient is diagnosed with MG. Back in the 50s, I was put on a few other medications, but they are not even considered in today's current treatment. And I think that's because researchers have come up with a much better understanding of what myasthenia gravis is, particularly in the last 60 years since I've had MG. In the late 1970s and early 80s was when they realized that MG was an autoimmune condition as well as neuromuscular. This brought discussion between the immunologist and the neurologist and the use of immunosuppressive medications to treat myasthenia gravis. The drugs were originally developed as anti-rejection treatment for organ transplant patients. But because I'd been so involved with the MGFA, when I attended the 1985 National Conference, several doctors at that time presented lectures on the various immunosuppressive drugs and the wonderful results that were being revealed. At that time, I was really having a bad time with my MG. I was taking 260 milligram Mestinon tablets every 2 hours and was on 60 milligram of prednisone a day. And I still wasn't functioning well. So after hearing the lectures, I made an appointment with one of the physicians who presented. And after testing, he put me on Imuran, which is a generic name, azathioprine. I was on Imuran for 10 months before I even began to feel any improvement in my myasthenia symptoms. However, gradually the severity of the symptoms decreased, and over a 5-year time frame, I was able to reduce and ultimately eliminate prednisone and decrease Mestinon to 260 mm tablets a day. Eventually, the symptoms were decreased to the point that I rarely even thought about having MG, which was wonderful. As all of you know, this constant medication throughout the day can be rather interesting, to put it mildly. So for me, azathioprine was a miracle drug. It was not a quick fix, but in the long term, it had wonderful benefits. Just to share also with you, I'm currently on what is known as a stabilized condition and maintenance dose of the medications. I take my pills twice a day and go about a normal routine. This is someone without MG. So I'm very thankful that the drug works so well for me.
Esther, if you don't mind me asking, is azathioprine the only drug you're taking right now?
I am on 2 Mestinon a day.
Okay, you're still on the 2 Mestinon.
Yeah, I probably could get off of them, but once you've had them forever and ever, it's like, oh. And I do notice a little bit not the symptoms once in a while. So.
Okay. All right. So let me just summarize the medications that Esther has mentioned. She mentioned pyridostigmine, also known as Mestinon, and that's what we call a cholinesterase inhibitor, and it improves the nerve-muscle junction communication, and it gives the neuromuscular junction a boost by inhibiting an enzyme that breaks down the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. So acetylcholine, the neurotransmitter, hangs around longer and boosts that neuromuscular junction. Now, the cholinesterase inhibitors do not address the underlying cause of myasthenia gravis, which is an autoimmune problem. And so most patients end up needing some form of immunotherapy. The good thing about pyridostigmine is it has very few side effects. Patients may have some stomach cramps or diarrhea, particularly at higher doses. But in terms of serious life-threatening side effects, we really don't have much problems with cholinesterase inhibitors like pyridostigmine. Now, Esther mentioned that she has needed immunotherapy, and that's very common. She mentioned prednisone. Prednisone is very effective and very inexpensive, but it has many potential side effects, especially at higher doses. It can cause weight gain, hypertension, elevate blood sugars, acne, osteoporosis, skin fragility, bruising, mood swings, insomnia, etc. And those are pretty common at high doses and much less common at lower doses. Now, Esther mentioned that azathioprine, which is what we call a steroid-sparing drug, has been a very effective drug for her. We use those drugs, azathioprine, other steroid-sparing drugs like mycophenolate, to hopefully reduce the steroid dose over the long haul. And for Esther, it sounds like it took a few years for her to get off the prednisone, but I think we probably agree that we can attribute the fact that she got off the prednisone to the azathioprine. Now, the downsides of azathioprine and mycophenolate are the cost, the potential side effects, and the fact that it often takes many months to years to demonstrate any clinical benefit. Okay, Lisa, let's let you tell us a little bit about your experience with your treatments for myasthenia gravis.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Burns. At the time I was diagnosed, I had a lot of weakness in my face, mostly swallowing and difficulty breathing, especially taking deep breaths. So I was hospitalized. And in the hospital, I received plasmapheresis approximately every other day until I was stable enough for discharge. And after I was discharged from the hospital, I continued to receive plasmapheresis 3 times a week, and that lasted for at least a couple months. And after a year or two, my doctor switched me to intravenous immunoglobulin treatments. We also call them IVIG. And I got those, I would say, once a week, maybe twice a week if I had a period of bad exacerbation of my myasthenia gravis. But even despite the IVIG treatments, I experienced about 5 years of the roller coaster myasthenia gravis where it seemed to be settled and calmed down and everything seemed to be fine. And then for reasons I couldn't figure out, it would be exacerbated. And again, I would have troubles with a lot of the muscles in my body, especially the face and arms and legs. So my doctor started to think about other options, and we just started to discuss thymectomy. Now, this wasn't a very easy decision, and I certainly didn't feel that I should make it one-sided on my own. And there were several factors for this. One, I did not have a tumor in my thymus gland. And number two, there was a question of whether I was stable enough for surgery, whether myasthenically, especially with the breathing issues, whether I would be stable enough for them to perform the surgery. And the third factor was that I was thinking about this back in 1993, and the surgeons at that time didn't have a lot of the less invasive surgical techniques that they have now for the thoracic area of the body. So what I want to say about helping me make my decision, the key for me was that I was building a relationship with my neurologist, and we were able to discuss these factors back and forth. There was a lot of consideration and deliberation between the two of us. And some of the factors that tipped the scale for me to decide to have the thymectomy was that it had been 5 years since I was diagnosed, and despite treatments with Mestinon and prednisone and Imuran, I was still having symptoms. I tried a lot of non-medical treatment, just some types of self-help techniques that might help with getting an exacerbated state of myasthenia gravis. And those were, I tried to stay out of heat. I tried to stay not having my body overheated. I tried to avoid antibiotics that might cause a myasthenic crisis. I tried to reduce a lot of the physical and emotional stress that for me it seemed to precede a myasthenic crisis. I tried all these things, and despite that, I still had what I call the linguine legs, not my legs feeling like they were 100-pound lead weights and not able to move forward. And for my arms, same thing, 100-pound lead weights, not being able to lift them. So I was also told that there'd be no guarantee that the thymectomy would help. And if it did, I wouldn't be able to tell for about 3 to 10 years. But I'm happy to say that I had the thymectomy back in 1993, and I'm just so delighted that 3 years from the day of that thymectomy, those periods of severe exacerbation completely went away. And I've not had to have any IVIG or plasmapheresis since that 3-year anniversary of my thymectomy. And I'm even more happy to tell you that I'm able to live a full life, the life that I want to live right now, working full-time as an administrative law judge, singing in a small women's ensemble, and doing volunteer work here and there. So I just want to kind of tell you a little bit about the treatment I'm on right now. For about the past 25 years, I've taken 2 Mestinon tablets, which equals 120 milligrams of Mestinon. So the way I break it up, it's 2 60-milligram tablets of Mestinon every 3 hours. And then at nighttime, I take the 180-milligram time span for Mestinon, and that seems to carry me through the night just fine. And I also take immunosuppressives. It's kind of killing 2 birds with 1 stone. I also have rheumatoid arthritis in addition to myasthenia gravis. And those immunosuppressives include methotrexate, prednisone, and then a biologic drug that I inject into myself, which is called Enbrel. So that about sums it up.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, Lisa, I heard you mention pyridostigmine, and again, that's a cholinesterase inhibitor. It gives a boost to the neuromuscular junction. You also mentioned prednisone, which we talked about earlier, being effective and inexpensive but having side effects. You mentioned azathioprine, also known as Imuran, and that's a steroid-sparing drug. You mentioned plasma exchange and IVIG. Now, plasma exchange requires a central line, and usually, but not always, a hospital stay. Usually a central line, I guess is what I should say. Sometimes patients can get plasma exchange with peripheral access. It is usually well tolerated, and it is thought to be effective, but the effectiveness of plasma exchange seems to only last a few months, and given that it's invasive and requires a venous access, it's not necessarily considered first line in terms of long-term treatment. Now, it works by cleaning the blood, if you will, by removing antibodies that seem to be what damaged the neuromuscular junction. So you mentioned that. You also mentioned IVIG, intravenous immunoglobulin. It is also thought to be effective. It's very costly. It's not without some risk. It's often not particularly well tolerated in that patients not infrequently have headaches or flu-like symptoms that can last for a few days. It's given through the vein as an IV and often at infusion centers. And you mentioned thymectomy, which has been a treatment option for myasthenia for about 70 years. It seems to be more commonly performed in younger patients, and there are a number of retrospective studies that support its use. However, the prospective randomized controlled trial is only now being done. If you're interested in the prospective multicenter study, there's information on the myasthenia.org website, and you can also Google MGTX and follow that link for more information about thymectomy. Okay, Lisa and Esther, would you mind summarizing what you think are the major points of today's discussion, the patient perspective on treatment? Who wants to go first? Esther?
Okay. I guess my take here is that I am so thankful that Imuran has worked for me, but I totally realize and want to make the point that not everyone tolerates the immunosuppressive drugs, nor does everyone have the same positive results that I received. And while many of you have the same symptoms, we are each individual. We're kind of like snowflakes, and lots of times MG is known as a snowflake disease, because we look alike, but we definitely have distinct differences in our symptoms of myasthenia. So it is vitally important that you work closely with your doctor to find the treatment plan that works best for you. and that this may take time and patience, but there are many options out there today, so keep trying and don't give up.
Okay, thank you. How about you, Lisa?
Well, the key point that I'd like to emphasize here, it's all about partnering with your neurologist. I was very fortunate to have a neurologist. We built a great working relationship together. But I wanted to note that this relationship, there's two players in it. So while I trust my neurologist and I'm going to rely on her expertise, trust in her expertise, I know that I also have a responsibility. And part of my responsibility is that I'm providing accurate information to her, that I make notes of when I experience exacerbation, that I'm honest about whether I take my medication, whether I'm exercising, what my diet is, so that type of information to her. It's also my responsibility to be educated about myasthenia gravis and educated about treatment options. And I think one of the biggest responsibilities I have as a patient is to follow through on what my neurologist is asking. And that way, when we have that team effort, we're really working toward making me healthy, but also what makes me happy in life. And I believe that partnering with your neurologist, you really can achieve a life where every single day you're fulfilling your purpose in life, what you believe is your purpose in life, and also have joy along the way.
Great. And I agree with you both. I think the major theme today is that there are many treatment options, but the treatment options need to be tailored to the patient. And physicians and patients need to consider a number of things when deciding on treatments, and that includes disease severity. Comorbidities are also known as other medical problems, such as diabetes and hypertension. We need to consider the goals of the treatments, and we also need to consider sometimes the prescription insurance status of the patient, given that there is such a difference in cost for these different options. And unfortunately, sometimes we're limited because of cost. We also need to further individualize the treatments based on the clinical response to a particular treatment and also the side effects experienced to the treatment. So there's clearly not a one-size-fits-all method to treating any individual with myasthenia. And so what might work for Lisa may or may not also work for Esther. And I think as Esther and Lisa said, we're not entirely sure what that is, but I believe genetic background must have something to do with it. But certainly that's not the entire explanation. So great. Lisa, Esther, thank you very much for your time today. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.